From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. The band The White Stripes has a new CD called Icky Thump. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Jack and Meg White. And we talk with Brian Cox about his recurring role on the HBO series Deadwood and about his stage and screen career. He co-starred in Woody Allen's Match Point, Spike Lee's 25th Hour, and he played Hannibal Lecter before Anthony Hopkins. The third season of Deadwood is now out on DVD. And film critic David Edelstein reviews A Mighty Heart, starring Angelina Jolie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our opening guests today are Jack and Meg White of the duo The White Stripes. They just released their new, much-anticipated CD, Icky Thump. It's their sixth studio album, their first for a major label, and many critics are raving about it. Here's the title track. That's the title track from Icky Thump, the new CD from The White Stripes. The White Stripes formed in 1997. Although they're eccentric enough to have remained an indie band with a cult following, they've actually developed a large following. Their single, Seven Nation Army, from their earlier CD, Elephant, won the Best Alternative Music Grammy. Jack White wrote several songs on the bluegrass soundtrack for Cold Mountain and had a small part in the film. He also produced a CD by Loretta Lynn called Van Leer Rose, which won a Grammy in 2005 for Best Country Album. Jack and Meg White don't talk publicly about their relationship to each other, and still coyly suggest they're brother and sister, though many press reports describe them as divorced. As Rolling Stone said earlier this week, being in the White Stripes involves following a lot of rules. No admitting you aren't related, no dressing outside the code, no playing with other people, no bass. Terry spoke with Jack and Meg White in 2005, following the release of their CD, Get Behind Me, Satan.
How did you both start playing together?
We started as I was just playing in the attic, and Meg sort of came up there, and I said, hey, get behind the drums, and, you know, I remember the first thing we would just play together sort of as a lark. We did Moon Age Daydream by David Bowie, and because Meg wanted to do that. She was really into that song at the time. And I have a recording of that, actually, still. I found it recently. And it just felt really good right off the bat. It just felt like something was different. And I think the reason why is because Meg's sort of childishness behind the drums really brought some new character to playing a song like that. And we started to play more and more, and it became this thing where, I guess it was Picasso maybe who said that he spent his whole life learning, took his whole life to learn how to paint like a 5-year-old. I'm not sure if it was him who said that, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's how I felt about Meg, you know. She's painting like a 5-year-old, she's playing like a 5-year-old. She's playing drums just like a little child, and I wish I could do that. I wish I could play the guitar like a little child, you know.
Now, Jack, you play drums. That was your first instrument before a guitar.
And, that's right.
From what I've read, it sounds like you used to record drums and guitar when you would record stuff in your room. So when Meg started playing drums, did you want her to sound at all like you sounded, or were you looking for something completely different?
No, that was what struck me. I mean, it started at sort of as that lark thing with just sort of messing around, you know, and then it became something beautiful it very, very quickly. And it became like, wow. And so I didn't want Meg to play proficiently at all, no. And matter of fact, I said, please don't practice, you know. Please don't play by yourself because it's just going to ruin it, you know.
So, Meg, now that you've been playing for several years, have you become more proficient in spite of Jack's urgings?
I suppose a little bit, yes. It's still probably not on the level of, any of the classic amazing drummers, but, probably better, certainly better than I was then.
And Jack, is that ruining things for you?
No, I think she keeps it tethered on it. You know, she really keeps the whole band, the two of us, you know, she keeps the band anchored.
Okay, so you're from Detroit and you're interested in blues, in rock, in obviously you've listened to a lot of punk and heavy metal too, in mountain music. You have all these influences that, you know, it's easy for us to hear in your recordings. Did you go through a period of not only asking yourself whether you could play the blues being white, but if you could play mountain music being from Detroit or play early rock and roll because you grew up in the 70s and 80s? I mean, did every step you turn lead you to questions about, am I authentic enough? Or did you early on just decide, well, you know, I love it. It doesn't really matter whether I grew up then or I lived there or whatever.
We had a good experience in the White Stripes because we started off at the sort of whatever the lowest level you could of just, you know, playing at the Gold Dollar Bar, which is like a block from where we're sitting right now, which was this little local scene. Garage rock was happening. We're just, you know, warming up for the bands and, you know, gradually getting to play out of town in Toledo or Chicago, you know, whatever. We just sort of built it up from the absolutely nothing. And then that kind of showed, you know, me, because people really liked us in Detroit and embraced us immediately, which was really surprising. And, you know, we were like their secret band. And then we were this, you know, secret band of like people in Chicago or whatever, you know what I mean? We just kind of kept going on. And we started to learn this thing that no matter what you did, you know, some people were really going to like it, and some people were really not going to like it. And some people were going to like it for the wrong reasons. Like, it's part of their identity to have a secret band that they, you know, it becomes part of their personality. And once you get more popular, they don't want to be a part of you anymore because they don't like it for the music's sake. They like it for other reasons. So that kind of taught me early on that, you know, I can't think about that anymore. You know, I can't concern myself with that. That's just too cool, you know, or too cool for me. I mean, I can't. I mean, I love mountain music, and I'm going to play it, and I can't think about if it's going to fit with what we're doing or not. It just has to happen, and I think this band has been really great with that, that a lot of things have been able to work with very limited means. We've tried to make each song have its own personality on each record and not have a whole album full of the same monotonous riffs over and over and over again. And I feel such a breath of fresh air when something like Little Ghost on this record kind of comes up, because it makes, so you can take a nice deep breath and feel something, totally different personality.
Well, before we hear Little Ghost, would you talk a little bit about writing this song, Jack?
Yeah, I wrote this song at a friend's house in... they had to leave me to watch the house for a minute, and I wrote the song in 10 minutes, matter of fact. The idea just came out. I don't know what... I just kept thinking of this phrase, Little Ghost, and it just came out quickly. I started to think about being the only person who sees something, and maybe that's kind of the feeling you have when you're in love with somebody, that you're the only one who notices all these beautiful things about them. You know, and you kind of tell your friends, hey, isn't she great? Isn't she great? And like, yeah, she's okay, you know, but they don't see her the way you see her, you know, that sort of feeling. Almost, I just wanted to equate it with somebody that you actually could not physically see, you know, a dead person, a ghost.
Little ghost, what I'm scared of the most, can you scare me up a little bit of love? I'm the only one that sees you, and I can't do much to please you, and it's not your time to meet the Lord above. The first moment that I met her, I did not expect the specter. When I shook her hand, I really shook the glove. She looked into me so sweetly, and we left the room discreetly. No one else could know the secret of our love. Little ghost, what I'm scared of the most, can you scare me up a little bit of love?
only one that sees you, and I can't do much to please you, and it's not your time to meet the Lord above.
That's Little Ghost from their 2005 CD, Get Behind Me, Satan. More of Terry's interview with Jack and Meg White after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Jack and Meg White. Their new CD as the music duo The White Stripes is called Icky Thump.
Now, we just heard a mountain music kind of song that you wrote, Little Ghost. And you produced an album by Loretta Lynn. And it was her first solo album since the 80s, I think. Very stripped down. There's even just a voice and guitar track on it. Why did you want to work with her?
Oh, I'm absolutely in love with Loretta Lynn. There's no doubt about it. I had been such a huge fan and was struck so hard by Coal Miner's Daughter, the movie. That's the first experience with her, and as a child, you know, and it just grew and grew and grew, and I just became so enamored with her songwriting style. I just couldn't believe, you know, what she was doing. She's sort of these doubled choruses, you know. And it was just so brilliant. And it just seemed like, how is she doing this? And I remember talking to her while we were working on the album. She's like, yeah, everyone always tells me, Jack, you know, I'll write backwards and all these things. And I think, yeah, I think you kind of do write backwards. And so clever. She's so clever and talented. I mean, like, how could I not resist that?
You know? So did you ask her to work with you?
Someone told me... that I think it was her manager said, you know, Loretta's thinking about making, you know, maybe one final album or one more album. I said, well, you know, I said, if I can throw my name on the pile, you know, I'd love to produce it. If there's any, I figured there was no way it was going to happen. Matter of fact, I did it without a contract once it did, you know. We went down to record some demos at this guy's house in East Nashville in a home studio as well. We went down to record some demos, and Loretta had sent me 10 songs when her and her daughter... singing, maybe actually her daughter had just recorded the demos herself on acoustic, I'm not sure, but about 10 songs she just picked off the pile of hundreds of songs she had written. And we recorded 8 of them the first day, and all 8 of those are on the album, you know, and it was so special, I just couldn't believe it.
Well, I want to play one of two tracks, and I'll name the two, and then you could decide which of them.
Okay.
These are my two favorites. One is Family Tree, and one is Miss Being Mrs.
Oh. Well, I'd have to say Miss Being Mrs., because that's really special to me, because that's just me and her playing.
Oh, that is you. I wasn't sure if that was you.
Mm-hmm. It's me playing guitar and her singing, and we just did it live. That was the second take of the song, and that was another song. I was assuming that we were going to eventually move on and maybe make it into a full band song, possibly. But after hearing that playback, it felt so good to sit in that room and play and back her up by myself. How selfish of me, you know, to take that opportunity. But it was just so, so wonderful.
Well, I'm glad you didn't change it. So this is Loretta Lynn with Jack White on guitar.
I lie here all alone in my bed of memories. I'm dreaming of your sweet kiss. Oh, how you loved on me. I can almost feel you with me here in this blue moonlight. Oh, I miss being Mrs. tonight. Like so many other hearts, mine wanted to be free. I've been held here every day since you've been away from me. My reflection in the mirror, it's such a hurtful sight. Oh, I miss tonight. Oh, I miss being misser tonight. Oh, and how I love them loving arms that once held me so tight. I took off my
That's Van Leer Rose, which is an album by Loretta Lynn, produced by Jack White. That was Jack White on guitar. Jack, what was your style? How did you start to sing? Like, what came first for you, playing music, writing songs, singing?
Playing the drums came first for me, and then I needed something to play the drums to. You know, I had a little four-track reel-to-reel in my bedroom, and, you know, so I started to teach myself how to play guitar so I could play along with something. Me and another friend I went to high school with, his name's Dominic Suchita, and we had he liked music, you know, rock and roll and all that too, so we started to learn things together, and he was playing bass and stuff, so we started doing these little recordings and covering Bob Dylan songs on record and whatever, you know, I don't know, whatever we were doing, and so it kind of built up from there, and then I started to get into this band, the Flat Duo Jets, when I was a teenager. And I worked at this upholstery shop. I was apprenticed for this man named Brian Muldoon. And after we were done at work, he played drums, you know, so after we were done for the day, we would set up the drums and the guitar, and we would play songs. And we were really into this two-piece band called the Flat Duo Jets, who were doing lots of kind of rockabilly and punk sort of music, but also throwing in these really gorgeous ballads, you know, from the 40s, you know, things that Patti Page and people had sung. And so I started to get more and more exposed to those kind of chord changes, I think. I started playing, you know, things like, you know, see the pyramids along the Nile, you belong to me, and things like that. And I started to get into that, those chord structures, you know, something I would not have been exposed to. And songwriting started to come out of that. And then once a couple years later, I really, really got deeply into the blues. And I think some kind of that also sparked a little bit more of the songwriting. And I sort of opened up. And the poetry I'd been writing, or whatever I'd been writing, I don't know. And I started to work it together. I started to discover what you could do. Could you write the words first and then the music? You write the music first and the words and all that jazz. And, you know, I started throwing them together and started to, by the time me and Meg were playing the band, I think it was started to come to something interesting.
Now, Jack, you grew up in a family of like 10 kids. I think you were the youngest of 10.
Mm-hmm.
So did your brothers and sisters look after you, and did they?
Oh, boy, did they. Uh-huh. Oh, boy, did they. It's like having 10 parents.
Was that a good thing a bad thing?
I don't know. I really don't know. I've been asking myself that my whole life. I suppose God bless them, because I love them very much, and they were always very helpful to me, and in good and bad ways, by learning, you know, when you're the youngest, you get to learn from everybody's bad example, you know. You learn how to not make the same mistakes that everyone else made, and you know, you get a different perspective on things. My family also has a very big, chip on their shoulder about pride and ego, about not patting somebody on the back when they're doing so well. So it sort of makes you try harder, I think, to impress, and almost this never really satiated feeling, you know, that I was sort of never really encouraged out loud, you know. You know, it was sort of, yeah, okay, what you're doing is okay, but you could be doing it better, kind of a feeling, which kind of became a frustrating thing to me when I was a teenager. You know, it was like, forget this, man. I don't need this kind of mentality anymore. I feel good about what's happening, or whatever I'm working on, or whatever furniture or music or sculpture, whatever. And, you know, I don't need this approval anymore. You know, and I think that's what really shaped me, was the letting go of that.
You mentioned, you know, you were apprenticing in an upholstery shop. Did you see your future as lying in furniture?
I don't know. I remember, when I was working there, I was really into music, you know, and I would just kind of thought, it just seemed like even playing a live gig was just this impossible thing, you know. How could I ever be in a band and play a show? I didn't even think that was, it was just never going to happen, you know. Especially the current sort of the attitude in Detroit kind of doesn't make you think that, you know, you're going to have a chance. I mean, maybe in L.A. or New York and things like that, that people kind of around you sort of make you think, yeah, you maybe one day you'll get on television even if you got the right friend, you know. But Detroit doesn't make you feel that way. And I didn't even think that I would ever be in a band, for one thing, let alone play on stage or let alone write music. And so, yeah, upholstery was the big sort of thing that I was doing. And I worked in a couple other shops, too, and I eventually opened my own Third Man Upholstery. I had my own studio where I worked on sculptures and did people's upholstery and antiques. And I started to, I made the big mistake of bringing, you know, guitar to my studio and eventually not getting any work done because I was playing guitar all day long.
So were you good at this, you know, at upholstery?
It's an extremely difficult trade, you know, and I was, you know, I'm coming from the man I worked for, Brian Muldoon. He's sort of a super perfectionist, and he was working on mid-century modern furniture, you know, like the Ames and Jakobsen and all these great designers were probably the most difficult type of upholstery to do, you know, gluing fabric directly to foam and all this jazz. So it was really hard. So I started doing these old settees and little 1800s furniture for these old ladies and things like that. And, you know, I could do that all right, but I remember going and talking to the other upholsterers at the supply place when I'd go and buy springs and staples and whatnot. I said, you know, how long is this going to take me before I start making money easily? It's not a hard thing to do. And he's like, probably 8 to 10 years it took me. It's like, okay. I don't know if I got it in me, man.
Well, Jack White, Meg White, thank you so much. Congratulations on the new CD.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Jack and Meg White speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. Their new CD release is Icky Thump. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm bringing back doors that are no longer there. I'm getting hard on myself, sitting in my easy chair. Well, there's three people in the mirror, and I'm wondering which one of them I should choose. Well, I can't keep from laughing, spitting out these 300 mile per hour alcohol blues.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org. And from American Express, whose special edition CD, Instant Karma, the Amnesty International campaign to save Darfur, is at instantkarma.org/imagine. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Life in Deadwood. We talk with Brian Cox about his role on the HBO series. The third season has just come out on DVD. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film, A Mighty Heart, based on the book by Marianne Pearl, widow of slain journalist Daniel Pearl. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. The third season of HBO's Deadwood is now out on DVD, so we thought it would be a good time to hear Terry's interview with one of that show's many standout character actors, Brian Cox. On Deadwood, Cox plays Jack Langrish, a theater producer who brings his traveling troupe of actors and hangers-on to the opportunistic, dangerous frontier mining town. He plans to convert an old bordello into a theater. In addition to his recurring role on Deadwood, Scottish actor Brian Cox has appeared in Spike Lee's 25th Hour and in The Bourne Identity. Before Anthony Hopkins played Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs, Cox played Hannibal Lecter in the 1986 movie Manhunter. Terry spoke with Brian Cox in 2006. Before we get to their conversation, let's listen to a scene from the third season of Deadwood. Brian Cox, as Jack, is talking with old friend Al Swearengen, played by Ian McShane. They're plotting against George Hurst, the ruthless tycoon who owns much of the town. Jack's idea is to get close to Hurst by pretending to be a faith-healing masseuse. But Jack, being as theatrical as he is, doesn't exactly say it in those words.
Perhaps, Al, given the sleigh ride which ensues, the best connection to Leviathan may not be by harpoon.
Explain yourself.
I mean the inimical Mr. Hurst, suffering with discomfort at his back. The wiles of a bull***er such as oneself may have use as a feint to occupy him.
How?
Campaign towards relief. Protracted. Punctuated by Pentecostal whoops and manual pushes and prods while invoking arcane authorities. The host's unhealthy soul, reliable to sustain his symptoms.
Brian Cox, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your character in Deadwood.
I play a character called Jack Langrish. He's a character who actually existed. He's slightly different from the real character. He wasn't as flamboyant as perhaps I have, or David Milch has made him. And he's serving a clear purpose in the story of Deadwood. But he was an amazing man, because he was a man who toured theatre companies all over America during that particular time, and he had just lost everything and actually kind of like out of the ashes at the Chicago fire, he lost his company, and then within a week he had everything back on its feet again. He started off touring with about 15 people. He ended up touring with 115 people. He finally retired and he died as a senator, I think, in Colorado. He was a really, really interesting man, and he was the first person to really bring theater to the West. He actually did, in Deadwood itself, he did the American premiere of The Mikado.
God. Excuse me, that has to register on me. To think of the Mikado in Deadwood, the way Deadwood is portrayed in the series, is really hysterical.
Yeah, it is. It's a kind of, it's so odd, really. But it was fascinating. He was a fascinating character. And so he comes now to Deadwood. And basically, I think, you know, we've arrived in the third series. And, you know, if you look at the sort of graph and the path of Deadwood, you can see that culture, you know, having been through the whores and the boozing and what have you, and the kind of more basic things that was required in those mining camps, the miners themselves, of course, sought culture. They wanted theatre. They wanted, you know, they wanted burlesque, but they also wanted straight theatre. So, you know, language serves a need.
Because your character is a man of the theater and very into theater, when he's just having a conversation, he often sounds like he's proclaiming on a Shakespearean stage. You've performed in Shakespearean productions. What is the difference between how you actually perform Shakespeare when you're doing Shakespeare and this kind of Shakespearean sound that you've given this theatrical producer in Deadwood?
Well, it's to do with the technique of how to speak, for a start, how to sustain a thought on one breath. Shakespeare is all about breath as thought, but a lot of his cadence is very, very long. You know, the iambic carries you through, and I mean, there's a whole structure to how you play verse. But also, the idea is that everything is on the text. You know, the subtextual idea is a very, very 20th century idea, and it's a kind of thing that pervades American films, which is why we have this kind of Strasbergian effect, you know, this kind of, I think, basically phony Stanislavskiism, where the actors scratch and mumble and do all this stuff, and that's supposed to be real, you know. But the interesting thing about somebody like Langrisch is his language and his training and his craft and his appreciation of words infects him. And you get that with theatric types. I mean, it's slightly dying out in the way it was now, but I worked, for instance, with John Gielgud, I worked with Ralph Richardson, I also worked with Laurence Olivier. And they had a cadence, they had an ability to use a phrase in a particularly erudite and extraordinary way. They were part of that breed of actor. And those Victorian actors excelled at it, absolutely excelled at it. It was the way they spoke. It was the way they thought. How they got up in the morning, that's what they started with till when they went to bed at night.
I want to get to another role that you've had. And this is just such a terrific performance. It was in the film The 25th Hour in 2002. This is directed by Spike Lee. And I want to play a scene here. Edward Norton plays someone who's about to serve a long prison term, and the film is set in the 24 hours before he has to report to prison. And this is like the last scene of the film. You play his father, you own a bar, you're driving your son to the prison down a long country road, driving him from the city to the country where the prison is. And his face is beaten raw. He's actually had somebody beat him up so that he wouldn't look too pretty or too weak and innocent when he got to prison. So he's sitting in the car with his face beaten up. You're driving, and then you say to him, just give me the word, and I'll take a left turn, and we'll find a nice little town that you can hide in instead of reporting to prison. So here's some of that scene we'll pick up right after you've made that offer.
If you want it, if that's what you want, I'll do it.
Oh, I'd take your bar.
My bar. Jesus, my bar. They can take my bar to hell and back. You think my bar is more important to me than you, my only child? Give me the word and we'll go.
They'll find me. They'll find me sooner or later.
You know how they find people? They find them when they come home. People run away, but they usually come back, and that's when they get caught. So you go, and you never come back. You never come home. We'll drive. Keep driving. Head out to the middle of nowhere. Take that road as far as it takes us. You've never been west of Philly, have you? This is a beautiful country, Monty. It's beautiful out there. Looks like a different world. Mountains, hills, cows, farms, and white churches.
It's my guest Brian Cox with Edward Norton in a scene from the film The 25th Hour. That is such a beautiful scene, and it's as if you're reading a poem with music behind you. So can you talk a little bit about doing that scene? Your monologue there lasts nearly 7 minutes.
It was an amazing thing. We, you know, the monologue was rewritten. It was actually rewritten on the day we recorded it. I mean, we did one version of it early on, and then we just did this other version because Spike fell in love with the whole idea of this redemption, regenerative, you know, thing that could happen to Ed's character. So he wanted more stuff. So David Benioff, who wrote the script and also wrote the original book, wrote this, I think it's in the end, it's about a 10-minute monologue, and it was quite amazing, and we just did it. You know, we did the scene, of course, with Ed and I, and then it goes in, it kind of makes a seamless change into the monologue. And it's just an extraordinary, I think it's a truly, truly extraordinary film, because it deals with so much. Again, it deals with, you know, because it was the first film to deal with directly with 9/11, in a scene where the two boys are down in Lower Manhattan, and Spike had the guts to kind of pan through the window, and he looked right down at Ground Zero, and it kind of gave the film an edge and a whole paean and kind of homage to America. And when I hear that script now, and I hear the fact of the celebrating of what is beyond Manhattan, what is beyond that place, it's just quite, it's so evocative and so poetic and so of the time. And, you know, I kind of really, I think it's a remarkable piece of work.
Brian Cox, you didn't really become well-known in the States until you were in, what, your 40s? When the film Manhunter came out in the 1980s, I think that was a kind of turning point in terms of American recognition.
Yeah, I was just in my it came out around about when I was, I made it when I was, I think, 39, and it came out when I was 40.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, you played Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter. What are some of the pluses and minuses of getting discovered by Hollywood when you're 40 as opposed to when you're in your teens or 20s?
Well, I think the obvious plus is that you're there. I mean, I've always wanted to be an actor for the long haul. I kind of realized that when I started really quite young. I was 15 when I started to work in the theater, and I went to drama school when I was just 17. I did my audition when I was 16, and I was working as a professional actor from the age of 19. So, you know, I was very aware that, and I think it's my Scottish canniness, I think it's what stands me in good stead. I was very aware of the fact that I would be, you know, that while I know it's an insecure profession, it's something I want to be doing down the road. And the irony is, of course, as you get older, well, actually, it's not ironic, it's a fact of life. You know, experience comes to you. So the thing that's more interesting is as you get older, because you have been dealing with life. So in a way, your work gets richer and you know more about your job and you're able to offer more. And the most interesting work for me is the supporting work. You know, in the theatre, I'm a leading actor. And I will always go back to the theatre and assume that role, but I can do it less and less because it's expensive. But in the cinema, it's knowing where your place is and knowing that you want to be a supporting actor. So you come in and you give the colour to a movie in a way. You know, because I've got colleagues back in England who say, well, I could never play small parts in films, you know, or anything like that. And I just think it's a nonsense, really. I mean, Michael Powell once said the great thing about cinema is that there are no small parts or big parts. There are only short parts and long parts, i.e. you're on a film either for a long time or you're on it for a short time. But when you're on a film, whatever, you know, when you're there, that's you. You're doing it.
Brian Cox speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Brian Cox.
I know your father died of cancer when you were 9, and your mother had some kind of breakdown and was institutionalized. Yeah. For how long was she institutionalized?
She was institutionalized for about, on and off, it was about 2.5 years, 2.5 to 3 years.
Was there ever a diagnosis?
Well, basically, she had a massive nervous breakdown, and she did try to commit suicide at one point, and I think just everything became too much for her, and she just completely physically and mentally collapsed, and they didn't know what to do with her for quite a while, and then they finally decided to give her electric shock treatment. So they gave her electric shock treatment over a period of about 6 or 7 months, and then she had to recover from that. So it was a kind of long, drawn-out process, and, you know, it was quite, I think it was very difficult for her. It was a very painful time for her.
So you must have had it pretty rough. I mean, by the time you were 9 or 10, you were, in some ways, almost orphaned because your mother was institutionalized, your father had passed away.
Yeah, I had these wonderful sisters who, I have three elder sisters, and I have a brother as well, a brother who's older than me. There's a kind of, the war is between us all. My sisters were born, I mean, I've got sisters who are 16, 15 years older than me, and they're still around. I mean, they're fantastic women, truly fantastic women. They were fantastic to me when I was a kid. I mean, they really were. They saved me. I mean, my childhood was great. I mean, in recent times I get a little bit... I get a little bit concerned because I seem to give the wrong message about my childhood. Actually, my childhood until my father died was really pretty amazing. I mean, my mother and father had problems, but they had problems which was to do with my dad made some, you know, he during the war he did quite well because he had a tiny shop and he made some very bad building investments and lost a lot of money, and that was in the background. But basically, we were a very happy family.
You left home when you were around 15.
I left home. I still lived in my home, but I was hardly ever there because I was working in the theater. I really left home when I was 17.
And did you leave home because you were unhappy there, or because you wanted to start looking at theater more seriously?
No. You know, when I left, it was really because I had a very strong accent, a very very strong Dundonian accent, and I had to go to drama school. And I wanted to go to drama school, and really in order to learn the craft of acting. And I wanted to go to London because I didn't want to go to Glasgow. I really, you know, I needed somewhere where I could learn how to speak, you know, what they call standard English, which I've never been able to speak.
What do you think of your accent as sounding like now?
Well, my accent is a sort of hybrid of so many things. You know, I think I've lived in England for, you know, on and off most of my life, but I've also lived in America. I mean, it's been very difficult because I've got this line in this play. I'm doing this Stoppard play in London, and I've got this line where I say to the woman who plays my wife, just, you know, who's had cancer, I say, and she's had a breast removed, and I say, just don't lose half your bum, that's all. And I keep saying, but. I get told off very firmly by the, it's not but, it's bum.
What about the accent or the dialect that you're using in Deadwood as the theatrical producer?
Well, that was originally, you know, it was so odd because I originally was going to play him American, but then I realized that he was indeed Irish. And there was a wonderful actor called Michael McLeamore. Michael McLeamore was the man who gave Orson Welles his first job. Him and his lover, who was called Hilton Edwards, ran the Gate Theatre in Dublin in the 20s. But Michael became this sort of grand dame because he was gay, but he was this very sort of, and he always wore full makeup, and he wore a black toupee. And actually, the irony was he wasn't really Irish, but he pretended to be Irish because he loved the Irish cadence. And he loved that way of speaking, that wonderful way of speaking in that Irish voice. And so I kind of thought this was a very good kind of template for Jack Langrish. So I kind of used a bit of that.
Now, I've read that you've said that you don't like to watch your own movies. You don't like to see yourself on screen because it makes you feel like the Elephant Man. You said, I come across as a sort of creature. I never seem like a human being. And I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, it's funny. I've just been doing some ADR for Deadwood this morning.
ADR? And, what is
that? Looping, you know, doing some extra additional dialogue required is what ADR is. It's where, you know, it's where you dub yourself on a screen, you know, like they might change a line and you have to, you know, you have to watch yourself on the screen and there's a little white line goes across and you play the line. So I had to see myself. And I just go, you know, it's just so odd. I think your own, you know, when you're in the mirror, you know, if you pass yourself in the mirror, you're still, or you see a photograph, you're still. But when you see yourself in motion, all kinds of, your face does all kinds of odd things and takes on odd shapes. And I get kind of spooked by it. I really do. My wife, she keeps saying, no, you must watch your work, you know, you really must. And I did when I was younger, I did, because I was vain. And I think it's still vanity that goes, God, this guy's so ugly. You know, it is the Elephant Man.
You know, and what you're saying is true in your mind, but so untrue in reality. But
yeah,
the reason why I'm interested in this is that you're dealing with this as an actor, but I think, like, so many people just deal with this looking in the mirror in the morning. You know,
yeah,
that it's just such a... a reaction that I think many of us have just looking in the mirror, like that.
Exactly.
That's how I look.
Well, at least in the mirror you're still, but you know, on screen you're moving.
Right, right. You even get to see how you look behind your ears and stuff.
That's
like
right.
That.
You yeah, know, and then you see a you know angle.
Well, Brian Cox, I wish you good luck, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a delight.
Brian Cox, speaking to Terry Gross last year. He's featured on the new third-season DVD set of the HBO series Deadwood. Coming up, A Mighty Heart. This is Fresh Air. Right after the September 11th attacks, Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl and his wife Mary Ann, also a journalist, arrived in Pakistan. Daniel Pearl was kidnapped in January 2002 and held for 5 weeks before his murder was broadcast to the world. Since his death, his widow has published 2 books, a collection of Daniel's writings called At Home in the World and a memoir called A Mighty Heart, which now is a movie directed by Michael Winterbottom. Angelina Jolie plays Mary Ann. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
A Mighty Heart tells the story of the hunt in Pakistan for kidnapped Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl through the eyes of his very pregnant wife, Mary Ann. The film is gripping. Apart from flashbacks that dramatize Mary Ann's idyllic memories of Daniel, it's clipped, blunt, and grimly realistic. It's almost a police procedural, with a focus on the nuts and bolts of the investigation. Our suspense is lessened, though, by our knowledge that it will end badly. And the movie's power might be lessened by director Michael Winterbottom's respect for the feelings of Mary Ann Pearl, who refused to watch the widely circulated video that documented her husband's final moments. This is the rare case of a film that doesn't bludgeon us enough. The movie's message isn't spelled out, but is easily inferred. Angelina Jolie, who plays Mary Ann, and her significant other, Brad Pitt, who helped produce with Mary Ann, didn't want to turn one of the most horrifying stories in journalism into a general indictment of Islam or Pakistan, or a movie about murderous anti-Semitism in the Muslim world. By sticking with the process, they show how the team that formed around Mary Ann became an improbable surrogate family. I say improbable because they're a strange mix. Daniel's colleague, Asra Nomani, played by Archie Panjabi, is of Indian descent, which makes her suspect in the eyes of Pakistanis, some of whom put forward the ridiculous idea that Pearl's kidnapping was orchestrated by India. Then there's Will Patton. As a higher-up in the U.S. consulate, Patton has made a career out of embodying shifty American officials. A Wall Street Journal editor is a decent guy, but not a beacon of focus. And who knows which side the Pakistani captain, played by Irfan Khan, is on. When he's kidnapped, Pearl is looking at alleged ties between the so-called shoe bomber, Richard Reed, and the Pakistani police. The Pakistani government wants to play up the non-existent Indian connection. The FBI doesn't understand the country's culture. But it's the view of A Mighty Heart that Mary Ann and her team might have saved Daniel had his captors not been too eager to execute him. In their compound, she and others work the phones and internet and diagram the relationships among the major players. They're shocked to discover the truth about the sheikh that Daniel set out to meet.
Marianne,
we
have caught Jilani. He was in Muzaffarabad, but he is here now.
What did he say?
He's not involved.
Wait. I thought Jilani was the guy.
It was just a bait. He was used as a bait.
So there's no Jilani involved?
No. We go back to Aref, we go back to Sadiq and Bashir.
I don't see this as a negative thing, I have to say.
This is a setup. I mean, if Jilani has nothing to do with this, somebody's, these letters are bogus.
It's worse than that. It means that they've been planning something for weeks. And for weeks, he thinks he's meeting with Jilani, and there is no Jilani.
Right.
And whoever these people are, they're thinking about doing this for weeks.
There's a disbelief that now seems quaint, that hangs over the investigation. In late 2001, American journalists had little idea of the deadly labyrinth into which the war on terror would lead them. Marianne and Daniel, played by Dan Futterman, are no naifs. But as long as Daniel meets his subject in a public place, he considers himself an unlikely target, even as a Jew, for jihadists with a message to get out. Marianne is French and of partly Afro-Cuban descent, a challenge for a Caucasian American, even an exotic-looking one, to put over. It's hard to forget Jolie as who she is, but she's a canny actress, and she plays Marianne with brusque economy that's true to the real woman in interviews. Marianne took some heat for not seeming sufficiently emotional in her videotaped plea to Daniel's captors, but the movie makes the case that she has to tamp down her emotions for the sake of her unborn baby. A Mighty Heart does not recreate any part of the videotape she refused to see, for which I'm grateful and sorry. The film needs something visceral to drive home Daniel's fate. In writing about this movie, I finally forced myself to watch that atrocity video. Apart from my relief that the actual killing isn't shown, I was struck by how pointed its message, as articulated by Pearl on camera, is, that no American is safe. Since then, Pearl's death has shown up in the culture in myriad forms, if only subtextually, in movies like Babel. A Mighty Heart means to celebrate Pearl's life, but his death and what it represents is, like it or not, central to his legacy.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from Debbie and Norris Bishton, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jarvis Cocker. The British musician has a new self-titled CD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Well, you can stay all night if you want to. You can hang out with all of his friends. You can go.